sitting quietly. Letting the buzz and flutter of the day's activities just cool itself down. Subside. Natural that when we're doing things throughout the day, having to work and think and study and so on, that our minds get active. And then when we come to meditate, it's also natural that our minds should calm down. Leaving the mind in the heart. We say to ourselves the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Bringing into our heart a feeling of complete acceptance, forgiveness, discarding all of the negativity, confusion, doubts, complexities, and coming back to that simple childlike wish just to be happy. letting the feeling of metta well up inside, smooth and easy. Swelling and filling the whole body. And then taking that metta and spreading it out to all the people in this room. May all people in this room be happy. May all people in this room be happy. May all people in this room be happy. Metta back into the body. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Letting the words of Metta go. Letting the feeling of Metta fade away. And allowing the mind to return to a neutral space. Empty, open, clear. And with the mind empty and neutral, just take a minute to review over how that meditation went, inquiring into cause and effect. How did that work? What was the nuts and bolts of that meditation? What did I do? What did I stop doing? How does my mind now compare with how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. The sutta, the dog duty ascetic, of course, very memorable for its image of the two kind of extreme ascetics coming to see the Buddha, and their very bizarre and to us amusing practice. Obviously, something which we think is, you know, self-evidently bit kind of kooky, and but which they obviously took very seriously, and one of the I guess one of the lessons to be drawn from that is that we have to be careful of things that that in that case they were doing a practice which here and now was obviously quite painful and unspiritual in many ways, and yet was supposed to lead to the opposite results. And so in Buddhism there's always a feeling that there's this harmony of the path and the goal. There's not an opposition of the path and the goal, so that our way to Nibbana in very important respects presages and gives us an idea of what the goal is. And the closer we get to that, the more the path seems similar to the goal. And so the Buddha used the simile like a river, two rivers which merge into each other. And in the analysis of karma that we find in this sutta, I think is very nice from a Buddhist point of view, that we have, we start out with the black karma and white karma. So of course this is the dichotomy of the world, isn't it? This is the good guys and the bad guys. And no matter how sophisticated kind of worldly dialogue goes, it seems to still revolve around these two extremes, even when we adopt the more kind of subtle position of the third option, which is mixed black and white. So I guess in a worldly context, you know, we maybe can demonize the other. We say they're all evil, they're bad, and we're all good. And then we maybe can adopt a more subtle worldly position and say, well, actually everyone has some good and some bad in them. Which of course is perfectly true, but it's still a limited perspective. So I notice that in Buddhism, moral value or moral judgment falls on an act, not on a person. So we don't necessarily speak of a good person or a bad person, but we speak of good and bad acts. And this is very important to bear that in mind. It's become very popular kind of doctrine that we should, in modern times, that we should be non-judgmental. Sounds like a good thing, doesn't it? We should be non-judgmental. We certainly don't want to be judgmental. But of course when you say, well, you should be non-judgmental, then that's passing a judgment, isn't it? It's passing a judgment and saying judgment is wrong. So like many of these things that initially kind of sounds very nice, but at the end, when you look a bit closely at it, doesn't quite necessarily make sense, or perhaps doesn't quite necessarily make sense in the way that we might imagine it to at first. In that particular phrase of being non-judgmental in Western culture probably largely stems from the memory of the very powerful phrase attributed to Jesus in the Gospels where he said, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. So let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Of course it can't be let she who is without sin cast the first stone. Firstly, because of course we all know women are full of defilements and wouldn't be without sin. And secondly, because women weren't allowed at stonings, as we know, as we've learnt from Monty Python. So let he who is without sin cast the first stone. But that's not actually saying not to judge things, is it? Actually, if you look at it, what it's actually saying is not to punish, which is a kind of different thing. It's a different thing to say, oh yes, this person has committed this sin, than it is to throw a stone at them and try to kill them for it. So simply to say, you know, not to cast a stone is not quite the same as saying don't pass judgment. It's saying don't impose punishment. And of course it's, you know, it's one of these things that, that even though the word non-judgmental, of course, always sounds very nice, we can't actually, you know, when we're operating, when we're living in the world, we have to pass judgment all the time. So I personally not particularly impressed with the idea of being non-judgmental. I think it's more like, well, you have to use your judgment with care, with discernment, with compassion, with wisdom, and that you don't judge in order to punish, you judge in order to understand. So perhaps the word judgment is has too many connotations in English. That may be the problem. We think of the kind of the guy in a black gown and a wig who's going to sort of pound the desk with his hammer thingy and say, you know, you're sentenced to 20 years hard labor or something like that. That's kind of judgment. But I actually think maybe more discernment is more important. And so we discern, you know, what is the ethical quality of what we're doing. And there are two modes or two aspects, interrelated aspects of this in practice, in doing this in Buddhism. One way is that we discern the quality of something just from our understanding of the nature of that quality itself. Okay, and that's of course conditioned by our experience, by our views, by our ideas, and so on and so forth. So for example, we have the view that kindness is good. It's good to be kind. So this is our idea, and so we do things that are kind because we think that they're good. So this is one aspect of it. And the other aspect is to investigate the results of something. So in this case, if we do something that's kind, we do it and we see that you know, we perform an act of kindness for somebody and then it makes them happy. So that's nice, isn't it? So we see, oh, okay, that's good. We see that cause and effect. So these are two aspects, not really separate aspects of it, but two sort of practical ways of looking at what's good and what's bad. And of course, you know, the list of actual mental qualities that are good and bad in Buddhism are, you know, by and large pretty similar to those that you'll find in other ethical systems around the place. You might sort of shift the emphasis a little bit in some ways. For example, maybe kind of the emphasis on faith in terms of kind of a dogmatic kind of adherence to something which we don't know or understand, that might be kind of de-emphasized a bit. And the other kind of values, like a value of forgiveness, may be emphasized more than in some other ethical systems. But nevertheless, we can recognize fairly easily that these are good things, and we can understand that human culture is not possible without it, that it either disintegrates completely or at the very least will be damaged if these qualities of honesty, of kindness, and caring, helping each other, all these kind of Buddhist ethical qualities, if they're not practiced. Shouldn't really say Buddhist ethical qualities as they're not Buddhist in the sense that they belong to Buddhism, they're just Buddhist in the sense that they're recognized in Buddhism. And so on that level, in our lives, then we learn to try to recognize those different qualities, and the basic process is to first of all know in your heart what's good and what's bad, to recognize it, understand that, and then to abandon what's bad and to develop what's good. And that is the province of right effort. And so Buddhism is certainly not non-judgmental in that sense. There's countless passages when the Buddha says, abandon what's bad and develop what's good. He's quite clearly making a judgment in the sense of discerning that. But he's not condemning and punishing people for having bad qualities. He's recognizing that this is a natural part of all of us. So let's just work together, recognize these things honestly, abandon what's bad and develop what's good. And not always, but often, developing what's good is very simple. It's true that in some cases we're placed with complexities and dilemmas which are difficult to figure out. We're not sure what the right thing to do is. But most of the time, in the ordinary decisions we make in our life, that it's quite clear which is the route that's characterized by kindness, which is the route that's characterized by compassion, by intelligence. And usually we know that, actually, even if we don't necessarily make it conscious. Maybe we might be in denial or we might be confused, but if we take a quiet moment and sit and reflect on it, usually, not always, but usually it becomes clear what the right thing to do is. And of course the third category is the mixed karma of black and white, and interestingly that the Buddha characterized that as being the kind of quality which is similar to that in the human realm. And of course that's very realistic, isn't it? Because we're constantly surrounded by examples of mixed black and white karma, and we have to make those choices ourselves. And so again we have to use our judgment, our discernment as best we can in these cases. Sometimes it's not possible to really know what is the outcome and what is the best thing to do. And we need to, in some cases, we need to relinquish the expectation that we can actually find a clear-cut, once-and-for-all answer to that question. It just doesn't exist in every case. There are good and bad results that come from something, and you can't just decide that this, it must be like that, or should be like that, or shouldn't be like that. And so this is why we have moral dilemmas. And one of the things that I noticed, because I did moral philosophy at uni, and one of the things that I noticed was that one of the differences in approach between Buddhist moral philosophy and what I experienced as academic moral philosophy was that Buddhist moral philosophy or moral teachings focused on encouraging and supporting the practice of those things which were really clear-cut. So most of the time, most of the emphasis was on, you know, we know what's good, we know what's bad, let's really do what's bad and do what's good and avoid what's bad. Whereas in the academic field, they seem to kind of more delight in all the kind of really niggling, difficult problems and to try to work them out one way or the other. And in some cases, it seems almost endless. It is endless. You know, you're never going to find a once and for all answer to these things. So I found that was an interestingly different perspective, and so I found certainly that the Buddhist approach was better, much better for helping you to be a moral person. You know, it gave you more clarity and encouragement. This is what we should do. Whereas the academic approach didn't necessarily encourage more theoretical clarity around issues, but didn't necessarily encourage you to be a more moral person. Although, you know, having said that, I did certainly make myself important changes in my life after doing that, such as, for example, becoming vegetarian as a result of studying the issues around animal rights. So we, you know, we have these dilemmas. You know, abortion, is abortion right or wrong? And of course, nobody really wants to have abortion. And there's many kinds of issues. What about, is there a time that we can say, you know, before this period of time or after this period of time? What if it's immediately afterwards, like you have a morning after pill or something? Is that wrong? Or can we say, like, for the first, you know, 6 weeks, then it's okay, and after that it shouldn't be? Or one of my professors at uni actually argued that in certain cases infanticide could be justified. So even after the baby had been born, then in certain cases it could be justified to end the baby's life. So so that's not a, not an easy position to think about with any kind of mental clarity, is it? It's a very emotional kind of thing. But nevertheless, we do have to make those decisions. Or decisions around war is also a very difficult one. Self-defense, how can we justify how we have to look after safety and defense and so on, security, and does that justify killing, or in what sense does it justify, or what circumstances does it justify it, and so on. So there are many, many things that we consider that are in this kind of realm of maybe both black and white, doing things that are both black and white. And that can, we can actually, it's very, that realm is very interesting because you can learn a lot from it. And the value of studying those things is not necessarily that you're going to reach a better answer from them, from the study of them, but you may have a more informed answer. Okay, so say the question of abortion, which I raised before, you know, when one can have an opinion about whether abortion is right or wrong, but then you can have a more informed answer, and the recent studies that show that actually whether abortion is legal or not has no impact on the number of abortions that are performed, but only has an impact on the health of the mothers, that when abortion is legal, that the mother's health is much better. And when it's illegal, the mother's health is much worse, but it doesn't actually affect the number of abortions. And so even though that might not change your ethical perspective on abortion, but it might change the way in which you think it's skillful to approach that as a practical issue in society. So these are the kinds of things that we can learn, and the kinds of limitations of that realm. But the most important kind of karma is the neither black nor white karma. And this is the quintessentially Buddhist part of it. And of course, typically, as in Buddhism, is neither one thing nor the other. And those things that we try to avoid, getting too pinned down in one particular, one thing or the other. This is like, and sometimes I call this the mysterious third in Buddhism. In this case, it's the fourth, but actually the third is the mixture of the first two. So it's really like the third is something which is neither one thing nor the other. And that's always quite interesting. But it is actually something. It's not a nothing. Yeah. And in the sutta that we just read, we discussed this a little bit in the sutta class, but it's described as chetana. We have the three words kama, sankara, which seems to be used as an equivalent to kama. Kama may be more general, sankara being used more specifically for particular kinds of volitional act. And then chetana, which just means volition. But chetana seems to be used in a more neutral sense, that doesn't necessarily have an ethical colouring of black or white. And so that chetana, that volition, that intention, that will to abandon black karma, that will to abandon white karma, that will, that volition to abandon neither both black and white karma, then this is the karma which is neither black nor white. And so this is very, very important that we understand this, because this fourth kind of karma provides the framework within which the entire field of Buddhist practice takes place. If we have the right view. So if we start out with the right view that says, okay, here we are, we're stuck in samsara, we're trapped in here because of our own stupidity, let's try to get out of it. How do we get out of it? And then we realize that all of these other things, the practice of sila, the practice of ethics, meditation, or conduct during the day, everything like this is all within that framework that says, actually, I want to find an end to suffering. And so all the effort that we do happens within that context. That's why right view happens right at the start of the Eightfold Path. Right intention is the second one. So this is what we're moving. The intention is then the force which is actually directing our mind in one direction or another, so we can go in various directions, we can do various kinds of things. But whatever we're doing, it's guided by that right view which sits at the start. And so whatever we're doing, whatever we do from that position of right intention, that is all part of that karma that leads to the end of karma. So this is most clearly and powerfully present within the monastic sangha. Not to say at all that it's not present outside that, but it's most obvious within the monastic context. And we go through that ritual where we have like a symbolic death and a rebirth. And so we're born into this new realm. We look like babies, we've had a head shorn. And from that time onwards, everything that we're doing is in this monastic context, which places a different kind of perspective on things. If we sweep the path, we're sweeping not our own personal path, we're sweeping the path for the Sangha. If we read a book, then we read that book within that context of trying to understand, well, this is part of my education as a Sangha member, trying to expand my mind, expand, improve my thinking, or whatever it is that you're reading the book for. When you talk with people, then there's always that reminder that, you know, here I am, I'm in the Sangha, I'm a representative of the Sangha, I need to speak with kindness, with care, I need to listen carefully to what that person's saying, I need to respond in an intelligent and sensitive manner, and so on. So we're reminding ourselves. And all of these are part of the way that we're practicing the Eightfold Path. And whether it's the food that we eat, whether it's what we do in going through a walk in the forest during the day, just contemplating the stars at night time, just appreciating the chance to be here, to practice, to have the seclusion, the quiet. Whether it's the study that we're doing, trying to better understand the Buddha's scriptures, so that we can try to learn what was the Buddha's intention, what did he really want us to do and how to practice. And so on and so forth. All of these happening within that overall context. So all of these intentions, if they're done purely, then they're all part of that karma that leads to the ending of karma. And of course, you know, I certainly didn't mean to marginalize or exclude the lay people in saying that. It's just more clear in the case of monastics, but within the case of lay practitioners as well, that also if you can bring that special touch into everything that you're doing, so that you can do the same things, but it just has a broader dimension. I think this is really important to understand. Sometimes when we deepen or broaden our spiritual consciousness, sometimes that means that there are certain things which we did before that we're going to have to stop doing. And so it will challenge us in that way. Okay? So if the things we're doing that actively cause harm to others or to ourselves, then we need to stop doing those things. There's no messing around with that. On the other hand, there's many, many other things which are also part of our life which we don't have to stop doing. They're perfectly fine. They're either ethically neutral or good things. And we just keep on doing those things just as we did before. But we bring to them that kind of special sense that these things are happening within a context. And that context is this life's journey which is not just lived for the moment. It's not just live for the sake of enjoyment. It's not just live for the sake of getting what I can while I can. But it's lived with that idea of understanding that suffering at its root is brought about through the ignorance and confusion in one's own heart. And by acting in this way, by purifying the mind and straightening one's intention and one's activity, one's aspiration, then through that we can find the clarity of mind so that we can abandon the confusion and the delusion and the ignorance. So this is probably talking enough for this evening. I offer this to you for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Well spoken and to the point. Firm and good. Impressive.
I think Ajahn Brahm brings it up very clear with the with actions rather than the person. And he talks about the child in the supermarket who picks up the thing of milk and drops it and spills everywhere. And the mother says, "You stupid child." And instead should say, "That was the stupid thing to do, or that was the silly thing to do." So that, I guess, if the child grew up being called stupid continuously, then they begin to believe it.
Yeah.
Whereas if referring to their action, then they're suddenly referring to one thing that they did. So it's the same.
And it gives them the chance to learn. Yeah? Flow just like the Ganges and the Yamuna River flow into each other. So it's all about this gradual stopping. Just keep on stopping, and then eventually everything stops.
There is a movement to live ethically philosophically.
Ethically philosophically?
Mm.
which is...
I haven't been there, but I know that there is one. Live in an ethical, way, philosophical views.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly that you know, I mentioned about becoming vegetarian, but the leader of that movement, of course, was Peter Singer, and he's always been very sincere about that as well.
Mm-hmm.